Mahanman on 14 March 78.
You were saying you had a lot of trouble with filters.
Yes. I think we were trying for very high Qs. We had to get coils which were stable in configuration and didn't change with temperature. And we initially started off with coils wound out of fairly heavy material, about 3/16 inch copper rod.
Mm-hmm.
But tuning them was a problem too. And finally, John Murray came to the rescue again with coils wound on ceramic formers, which we dug up out of old radio transmitter equipment during the war. And we built, I think, special small condensers to tune them with. There were also a lot of problems with leakage. We were pumping a fair bit of power, 7 or 8 watts, out of our 7 megacycle amplifier.
Mm-hmm.
This intended to be cross leakage between things. And then at Potts Hill, being a fairly open site in the western area of Sydney here, we found a hut with an iron roof. Was just not a very good heat stabiliser. The whole thing went up and down madly, night and day. And every time it went, everything went with it. Our bandwidth in the IF channel changed, the filters changed frequency, even the output of various amplifiers, their gains and so on was changing.
Did you have the possibility of air conditioning?
Well, we ended up with a certain amount of air conditioning, not of the actual hut. We put the racks on which the equipment was mounted into cabinets, which were temperature controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Not at a low temperature, actually, at a fairly high temperature. We still had problems because our intermediate frequency preamplifier was up on the
aerial.
But we managed to stabilise it quite well. We then had problems with the coax cables coming down from the aerial. Temperature changes there were inclined to cause frequency shifts, bandwidth shifts and so on in the IF system. So we spent a long while going through this, sorting out each of these problems and knocking one on the head at a time until we got a workable system with which we then approached the Magellanic Clouds.
Now, how did this decision come about to look at the Magellanic Clouds rather than, say, do more on the galaxy?
I think it came about because of Frank's association with Harvard. Harvard was very Magellanic in those days.
Yes, Shapley and Bach.
Shapley was the main person who'd influenced Frank, I think, while he was there. And they were all interested in it. They had their Boyden Southern Station.
Right.
So the clouds loomed pretty large in our astronomy mind whenever it came to the surface.
And, mm-hmm.
And we were looking for something new to try and do too, so it was rather a challenge to have the statement from Shapley, I think, that the small cloud was gasless and the other one had some gas, so that was a good comparison to
mm-hmm.
make.
And so when you turned the dish to the cloud, did it just show up right away?
Yes.
No problem?
We didn't have any problems. Our frequencies were good, well controlled and so on. And we saw our clouds on the first night that we tried. But we saw both of them. We didn't just see one. Frank and I then split the observation periods between us, and I took the small cloud and he took the large. And we went through that first survey of the Magellanic Clouds. That's the first job we did with the four-channel system.
But these four channels are coming out on strip charts, so there's a lot of data reduction there.
Four charts, which each had to be read. We made up a lot of aids in the way of graticules and so on for the girls to read them, but at one stage I think we had about four girls reading these charts to get our data down. And it was all manually handled at that stage too. Frank, of course, was starting to wind up his interest in the galaxy quite a bit, and so we started the even more demanding job of getting the wider profiles from the galaxy with the sport channels.
Before we go on to the galaxy, let's talk about the scientific results that you got from the clouds. You took, I have here 250 positions. That must have been picking off positions from the drift curves that you...
What we did actually was, we had a beam width of 1 degree, and we knew we could spend a few minutes on each position without smearing our profiles too much. And to ensure stability in the whole system, we moved the aerial between the celestial pole and the cloud position that we wanted to observe.
Each time as a reference point.
Each time as a reference. So we had one scan of pole, which had no profile in it, and one on the cloud, and we just did this backwards and forwards arrangement. To do that, incidentally, we had to develop a magnetic clutch to drive the aerial. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to reposition it accurately and quickly.
Right.
We'd have been losing out there. We used to get our profiles about 1 every 4 minutes out of the system. Or at least our measurements, four measurements, we to get a profile took rather long. We had to add them all together.
But having put together this map, you were able to see that the clouds were rotating and moving with respect to the galaxy.
I don't think we'd have said that there was any rotation.
As a binary system.
Yes, they were part of the... We had this inkling of a binary system because there was a large translational motion, shift of frequency across them, which wasn't accounted for by galactic rotation. But it was once again mainly a question of producing contours of the intensity of the radiation over the clouds, and of course for the small cloud the fact that there was gas there at all in any quantity was...
In fact, the mass of hydrogen was comparable to the large cloud.
Yes. In fact, I think they're both the same myself. I think one's just a bit younger than the other and hasn't got going yet.
And this was quite surprising.
Other people's conclusions up to that time from the age of stars, I would think, in the two clouds, and people weren't seeing very many blue stars. They were saying the small cloud was old and had worn out. I think exactly the opposite was probably the truth, that it just hadn't started to get going yet.
Were the optical pundits willing to accept your data?
Well, very shortly after that paper was printed, I think Shapley, writing in some, I think it was Scientific American, he listed the seven most outstanding discoveries of the decade in astronomy, and he listed that as one of them.
I see.
So I would say yes, the pundit
accepted that result.
Accepted that result. Was very excited with it. I didn't have the opportunity to talk to Shapley myself, but Kerr did go back to Harvard sometime in the next year, I think, and worked again with them. And got a great deal of help, and I think at that stage probably started Vox's interest in the Australian scene.
Well, let's see, before we move on to our own galaxy, are there any other things that I should know about this Magellanic Cloud Survey?
No, I don't think so. It was, you know, just once we found that we could see the thing, it was a question of routinely going ahead and trying to put down a body of information which would be a guide to future observations.
There were no difficulties in how to interpret the data?
No terribly difficult ones. Most of the difficulties came in
getting it.
Getting it and reducing it by hand.
Right. Well, then you and Kerr moved on to the Milky Way, and can you tell me what the strategy was there?
Well, as far as I can remember, once again we'd sort of done some minor improvements to the receiver. We'd put in a new set of filters by that time, and
still four channels.
Yeah. And we had improved on the oscillator. One of our problems with the earlier work in the oscillator had been the tubes that were doing the final multiplication, and they kept blowing up one after the other. But at that, fortuitously at that stage, the valve companies came out with another version of the tube, which was much better, much more stable, and you could get your tripling without so much bother as we had previously. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some of the tubes wouldn't work at all. You'd have to put two or three tubes in before you get one that would triple, and they'd blow up every few weeks, and you'd have to start again getting this damned oscillator lined up. So we were in a better observational position, I think.
You still had the temperature difficulties, though.
Well, we had done most of the temperature control, but agreed we still had a few temperature problems going on. Most of these were taken care of, we hoped, by doing observations between the pole and the galaxy. But of course, once we moved to the galaxy, there was this problem that we now had a profile at the pole, and somehow or other we had to try and find out what that profile was.
Right.
We did this in a number of ways, mainly by shifting the frequency slowly, so it went one channel at a time or half a channel at a time across the profile, and we gradually built up a bit of history of observations of the pole profile, and finally drew one which we accepted as being our basic calibration.
But you were still going to the celestial pole rather than the galactic pole?
Yes, the celestial pole was still our main observing point. You see, a galactic pole wasn't available to us only once a day when it happened to turn up. I did do some observations around the galactic pole, and at the time I think got an inkling at least that the point that we used quite a lot later on, I can't remember exactly where it was. It was just a point off the galaxy. It seemed to fall in a hole where there was no gas at most frequencies, or if there was, it was only detected after we had the 60-footer and much more sensitive receivers. That point did prove to be a very useful zero profile.
Cold spot level.
Mm. But we couldn't use it very often anyway, so we did all the observations, I would say, against the celestial pole after making we did them while we were finding out, in fact, what the pole profile was.
So it appears like that beginning around, when, 55 or so, that for a long period of time there were observations on the Milky Way going on at Potts Hill.
We then sat down and just observed continuously. I think somewhere in that period Patty Carpenter must have shown up, and she was dead keen to observe. She didn't want to observe with anybody else looking over her shoulder. She wanted to do it herself. And of course, this was a different proposition to taking photographs with an astronomical telescope.
Mm-hmm.
There were knobs everywhere all over the thing, and you had to go through various sequences to shift the aerial, to shift the recorders to get zero marks.
She'd had no experience at Cornell?
She had absolutely no experience as far as I could tell at all. Anyway, I finally succumbed to a pressure to let her observe, and I sat down and wrote out a long list of movements that you make. You know, you shift your foot here and you move your left finger there, and you look at that and look at that and record this and that, step by step, right through the whole observing procedure. And I finally, she was satisfied that that was enough to do it, and I left her there one night to observe on her own at Potts Hill. Surprisingly enough, she was quite happy, and she did observe under those conditions. I don't know how. I'm even amazed that I didn't miss out some steps or something and foul her observations up. But the bit that did stick in my mind about all this was that a few nights after she started doing this, she had a car from the lab to get her from the city out to Botswana, and she was coming back somewhere around about 2 o'clock in the morning on the particular observing session she was doing. She got halfway into Ashfield here, stalled the car, tried to start it, putting her foot down on the accelerator very hard and pumping it up and down. And, you know, Holdens in those days just didn't start if you did that to them. And I got a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning. She was stuck in Ashfield. What'd she have to do to get this car going again? I talked to her for long enough to let the petrol leak out of the carburetor again, and told her to go and not to wag her foot up and down, just to put it down on the boards and switch, and away it went.
So that was the main problem, not the observing.
We got her back to town quite safely.
So, as you say, though, there's always had to be one person out there doing this observing, and sort of a continuous day in, day out, even weekends.
We did it over the whole week, 24 hours a day. Frank, as you may have gathered in your association with him, is a night person. He seldom goes to bed before 1 o'clock in the morning. But if you try to get him out of bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, well, that's a different proposition. He's just not going to come. So we finally decided, rather than rotate shifts, because I was a morning person and he was a night person, that we would share the shifts this way. And we observed about 16 hours a day, I think.
So you would come in the wee hours of the morning?
I came in first thing in the morning and stayed through till midday or so. And
what do you mean by first thing?
Oh, 1 o'clock.
That is first thing, all right.
Frank went on from there into the late hours of the night, and I got back again.
And what would you say were the main results over the years? The first thing I see here on this is the deviation of the galactic plane.
Yes, I find it a little bit hard. I think the first thing we actually did was to sit down once we had a good selection of profiles and try and trace out the other half of the spiral map, which by that time the Dutch people had published the northern section for.
Right.
Their methods of reduction and ours didn't coincide very well. We were inclined to look at the spiral arm as being traced by the ridge in the profile intensity and so on. They tended to do it rather differently and try and draw contours of everything that was there and then try and select a spiral arm out of the contours.
What do you mean of everything that was there?
Well, they sort of plotted their contours down to quite low levels of...
I see, whereas radiation. You just took the peak value.
We just traced the peaks around. It was a difference in philosophy, and of course the first maps that appeared, joint maps, had this peculiarity of sort of being half and half two different systems.
Right.
I think the first attempt to sort them out was when Colin Gum came to work with us after getting his PhD from Stromlo.
And he got his PhD in optical work? How was the decaying to work in radiophysics then?
I think he was influenced by Bock at that stage. Bock was always trying to push an optical astronomer across into the radio side, because he always said it was because they were going to broaden their outlook. But I rather suspect what he thought was they might teach us something about
astronomy. Well, it goes both ways.
Yes, sure. But I feel that the optical astronomers gave us a very good hearing. There were a few people who pooh-poohed the idea that radio astronomy would ever be a worthwhile science in its own right or something of the sort. But
would you name names?
No, I don't think I would do that. But on the other hand, yes, I will. There's one black. I've got a picture of him here. This black here in the middle.
Oh, Sir Richard VDR Willey. Yeah. Well, I certainly have heard that from other people.
He never was happy. That, incidentally, was the first joint symposium that we managed to organise in at Stromlo.
This was 56 or 7, I believe. Is that right?
No, I think it was well before that.
Oh, really?
That was taken in the walls of the 74-inch dome,
mm-hmm.
but the dome wasn't there with the telescope.
Oh, I see.
It was just the walls at that stage. So it was well back in the system, more like 53, 54, I'd say.
Interesting.
A lot of the earlier astronomers aren't
there. I've never seen this photo.
That one's a personal one. Well, it was my camera that was taken, and I got into the photo, so I can't remember who took it. but anyway, I think once Colin Gum came into it, Patty's presence helped a lot, because she did a lot of mathematical work on the rotation curve.
I see.
And drew us a whole lot of interpretation curves for distance against frequency and so on.
I just want to double check now. Martha Starr Carpenter is who you're...
Patty. Patty right? Carpenter. Mm-hmm. Yes, she didn't get married until just after we first came in contact with her. She was married when she came out here too.
Anyway, she was working on the theoretical side more or less.
Yes.
Helping you. And
She helped a great deal, as I say, with the rotation curves and that sort of thing.
And was it pretty clear cut as to, given a ridge and velocity at a certain longitude, and given a rotation curve, then you knew where to put that?
Where we could put a point down.
Right.
That seemed to work fairly well until you got round near the galactic center direction. Then the system started to break down some, which you usually found that the arm wanted to trail off to infinity quite suddenly, which I suppose wasn't unexpected, seeing that the frequency measurement needed to be much better to get you across that gap. I think we got one diagram published in that PASP thing that has an arm which sort of curls around, and then when it gets down here, it just dived off into space.
When it gets near the galactic center, it just goes away.
It took off very sharply. We were also fortunate, I think, in that characteristically the profile on our side of the galaxy tended to be very much more definitely broken up into a couple of large arms, whereas on the northern side it was much less distinct. And this, way back in that original set of observations, was probably a fortuitous help from God
to get the double
to allow us to see with our narrow spacing and switching and so on that there was a double line there.
I see.
Had they been closer packed or had small multiple arms or something of the sort, we just wouldn't have seen it.
Was there no difficulty in deciding how many features you were going to identify in a profile?
Not usually. Most of the profiles from Carina around are just straight profiles with obvious peaks on them. We're not dealing with little humps on the sides.
Right, that's what I mean.
We didn't start to discover those until quite a bit.
So basically the single noise was not sufficient to bring out that sort of structure. Well, when you did combine this with the northern results in this paper in Nature in 57, did it make a coherent picture?
There was quite a lot of discrepancies about the crossing the gaps on the sun center line. It's just you ran into the problem of not having any longer discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know where anything was. It could be local, it could be distant, and at one stage I did try to play around with the width of the line to try and see if you could find the further lines narrower in their effect and so on. But this fell down because the lines rather obvious, well, the arms rather obviously got fatter as they got further away from the centre. So we, I think that was partly where that shift of the galactic plane came from too, while we were trying to sort that, this out. We were drawing diagrams which fairly obviously the centre ridge line was dropping down as you drew your diagram further and further away.
Indicating a warp in the plane.
Which then Frank tried to interpret as being due to Magellanic processes. Might still be, I suppose, but
Did you try this Dutch technique of looking at the width of the hydrogen layer as a function of velocity and thereby for the double ambiguity business?
Yes. But once again, as I say, it tended, because the arms got very much wider and fatter further you went away, you almost tended to see a constant angular width.
Independent distance.
That didn't help.
Right. Okay, so there was the trouble going through L equals 0 and L equals 180 because of the low gradient and velocity, but you did have some areas of overlap.
Yes.
Yeah. And what about in those areas? Is there basic agreement or not?
Yes, I think so. There were problems there too, of course, because the areas of overlap meant that we were observing on the horizon. And we had to downgrade our system and say, well, we couldn't be so confident about it in that area. So if we had slight disagreements and so on, we just had to say it was an observational hazard that was appearing. I would think out of that particular galactic observation era that the work which doesn't appear in my papers of setting the new galactic plane and
Bosse and Kerr and
Ort and so on. That really was the major feature of that particular 5 or 6 years.
Defining the galactic plane.
Defining the galactic plane.
You think that was more important?
New set of coordinates.
You think that was more important than the structure?
I think so. My feeling was that in actually getting a new set of coordinates which allowed you to work in what you could picture to be the plane and not have to always be offsetting yourself by a degree and a half or something of this sort, allowed you, your actual picturing of the physical thing that you were dealing with to become more cogent in your thinking. I would rate that myself as being the major advance.
That's interesting. What about the width of the hydrogen layer? Was that
at
of any...
At the time, incidentally, we always had problems convincing ourselves that it was the right time to make this move, that we might want to change it again later on.
A decade later or something,
But I don't think they have changed it, have they?
Oh, no. I think
still
it'll, holding. I think it'll remain fixed. What about the width of the hydrogen? You've mentioned that it seems to be getting wider in the outer parts of the galaxy.
Yeah, I don't think we ever published anything about that. It is noticeable from the contours that have been published since that this is still a feature, that as the intensity of the line drops down in the outer regions, you're also getting an increase in width.
Also, in an AAS abstract anyway, you talk about the arms being trailing. Of course, was a controversy that goes back a few decades.
Yeah.
And you thought you could establish the shape well enough that you could distinguish those.
That's right. With the two main arms going around through the corona region, you'd have needed vast changes in the rotation parameters to make them do anything but trail.
I see.
Although it wasn't so obvious on the northern side, we felt that on our side at least, there was just no way that we were going to, without very large local motions, and they'd have had to be local over a quarter of the galaxy or something.
The map that was produced shows spiral-like features. Were you thinking of these as definitely real, physical clouds of hydrogen, and sort of virtually no hydrogen in between? What was the picture you had in your mind?
Yeah, I think I would have thought of it as, well, very intense concentrations of hydrogen anyway, in a general...
Yeah, very high contrast between...
Contrast was high between the inter-arm regions and so on. There were, of course, a spate of papers at that stage which tended to try and show that the optical arms weren't in the same place as the radio arms. I'm not quite sure what the resolution of that is at the moment.
That came along a little later, I think, in the 60s, more than the late 50s. But yeah, indeed, there's still some problems there. But also, it seems clear from like what you just say that there was quite a bit of cooperation between optical and radio by the late 50s on these problems.
Yes, so I'm not quite sure when Bock arrived here.
56, I think.
56, was it? Cooperation at that stage was just complete integration. There was no question. We were always down in his pocket. I've spent just legions of time. So I've spent the night with him observing, stayed in his home, had their hospitality for days on end, just getting together, talking about things, having group meetings and so on. The contact with Stromlo people at that stage was as good as it could possibly be, I think, particularly with people like Westland and Gascoigne, Golnow.
Well, going back to Bach's predecessor, Woolley, who you said was not very encouraging to radio astronomy. Nevertheless, there was this symposium held down there. So there was some contact.
Oh, there was contact. Well, among other things, for instance, Clay Allen, who was the deputy director there early in the piece, was interested in radio astronomy directly, and he in fact did have a 200 megacycle solar system down there. And I went down there on numerous occasions to touch up his system for him.
I see.
So we had an early contact, and Woolley, although I don't think he was antagonistic to the system, he just was an optical astronomer and he wasn't planning to get mixed up in radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. He didn't blame anybody else for having a go. He and I had some quite strong arguments, I suppose, about the relative value of these sort of things. That's just what happens between people when they're...
Sure.
In a field, it's good work. No, he would never have objected, I would think, to
He allowed Alan
between his people.
He allowed Alan to maintain this thing, of course.
I don't think any director would discourage people from having a go.
And what about the work that you did with Frank Kerr on the distribution of hydrogen as a function of distance from the center?
This was rather minor thing. Once you had a map, you could then go around and integrate the necessary bits and pieces and put them together. It was rather a matter of saying, well, this looks like something that we can derive from the results that we have, and it looked an interesting sort of result.
Basically, you found very little in the center.
Yes.
In terms of ratio of masses. Was this at all surprising?
No, I don't think so. By that time, we were starting to recognize the fact that there was an enormous central mass of stellar matter there. And the optical people probably knew about it a long while before we started to gather it. Plus the fact that we were also... becoming very conscious of things like the temperature of the gas. We initially had been a tendency to sort of accept that what you were seeing was in fact the temperature of the gas, but we'd seen inkling of absorption lines, for instance, and certainly in the direction of the center, it was being brought home pretty strongly that we were now facing a situation where you didn't really know what the temperature was, you didn't know how much gas was anywhere. You were dependent on too many variables,
right,
and parameters, and obviously the center of the galaxy was going to be a place where the temperatures were possibly going to get to the point where we no longer had the neutral transition to play with. I don't think we were terribly surprised by that result.
Well, now this was all taken with a four-channel recorder, and I believe it was about this time that you decided that that was inadequate.
That's right. Well, first of all, I think we had decided that the aerial was inadequate. And we started agitation to buy a 60-foot dish from the States. At one stage, I even had Bart arrange to send us a 60-foot dish on a Navy frigate or something of the sort, because we couldn't afford the freight for the blasted thing.
I see.
But anyway, we finally did get a 60-foot dish, but we never did use it on the hydrogen line. It got integrated into the Christensen cross system and was used on a survey of the Magellanic Clouds by Matheson, I think it was, on the continuum.
And in fact, it's the one that's at Parkes now.
That's right, the same 60-foot dish. I spent a little bit of time working on it with Matheson, mainly in calibrating and so on, before he did the survey, but we never did use that. I took 3 months long service leave for some reason or other, and when I came back from long service leave, all this time we'd been working on the Parkes system. Harry Manette was away in England with the design going on,
so right.
We were all feeding our pet ideas into that, but we were pretty fast then approaching the situation where the thing was on the ground, it was starting to grow. We were visiting it every month or so to see progress, to become au fait with what it was we were going to play with at a later date.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to start thinking on what equipment we were going to put onto it. All this time, incidentally, Murray and McGee now had been developing the 48-channel receiver, and they'd done some work with it. I can't remember a great deal.
They measured a couple odd locations in the Milky Way at Merrybank.
It became obvious that that receiver had to be a receiver on the big dish. We would have been there forever observing if we hadn't had a multi-channel receiver. And at the same time, Maston Beard, I don't know whether you've run into him.
He
used to work here. He's now with the computing research section in Canberra. He had for quite some time then been working on the on a computer which was built by Radio Physics, a thing called CIRAC. And Pawsey, while I was away on long service leave, had talked to Beard about the possibility of digitising the output of the multi-channel receiver. And by the time I came back from leave, Beard had a few basic pieces of equipment.
What year is this now?
This would be 59-60, I'd say. He had a few pieces of basic equipment available, and when I came back, everything else had finished up. We'd decided to close Potts Hill down. So I took over putting the digital equipment onto the multi-channel receiver.
I see.
John Murray got other jobs at that time. The multi-channel receiver wasn't working as well as it did later on. There were still lots of problems with it. Some of them due to temperature and so on. But anyway, I think initially we had a valve digitizer set up for the multi-channel receiver, which we put on it, saw that it worked, and ran the thing on that Magellanic survey, which involved Carter and quite a few people in that, because we had to have programming and the computer for the reduction. It was really an exercise in using the digital results.
What do you mean, Magellanic Survey? I'm confused.
We've got it down here.
I don't think so. I have the only
criticism. No, there's a missing one there.
It must have been published after 60.
Quite likely, yes. It's just possible it got on that borderline.
On the 36 foot?
No, this was done on the 24 foot at Murray Bank.
Murray Bank, I see.
But it was basically an exercise in digitizing the 48 channel receiver and seeing
testing for parts, basically.
Problems that you ran into in reduction and so on, getting used to computers and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started to learn new skills in programming and so on. Well, having got that working, we then decided that a valve system was probably not quite the right thing, and I designed a digital version of it, which was finally the thing that we took to Parkes. At the same time, we set to and rehashed the whole of the Murray Bank system to allow us to put it on the Parkes aerial, for instance, local oscillator, and we had to go 30 feet up at Murray Bank, but it had to go a lot further than that once we got to Parkes, and we had to make booster amplifiers to fit up in the hub room to get our oscillator up to the focus. It was too big to put in the vocal cabin. In any case, you want to change frequency, so it was awkward up there. We had to cope with larger losses in our IF system, all the rest of it. And we had to have a new feed for the 200 footer. So all around that 1960 period was spent getting all that boiled up, minor modifications made to the equipment.
But the front end was basically the same?
Front end. The front end was actually a combination. We'd done away long before, of course, with the waveguide system. But we had to increase the amplification and so on. And we had to get a new feed and integrate the preamp and so on with that new feed. So that was a sort of preparatory.
And did this receiver all work quite well?
That worked very well, because we took it up, all cables cut and everything else. We transported it to Parkes, unloaded it, assembled it in the various places up and down the aerial. That took about 3 days, 3.5 days. We then switched it on, and 2 days later observed the Magellanic Clouds again. It was, once again, one of those lucky flukes. I think to think of all the things that needed doing to get it there and plug it together and have all the right cables and so on. You had to be lucky.
And in fact, did you take part in observations early in the Parkes dish with this receiver on the Magellanic Clouds?
Mm.
And what were the things?
Hyman told me that the most interesting part about the Magellanic Cloud observations was finding two peaks, which he had been hints of before, but not definite. Then I asked him about what was the key to the success in radio physics over the years, and he said it was the instrumental orientation of the people, the fact that they were able to not only assemble receivers and aerials and so forth, but also to get them working and to fiddle and twiddle and to have a real instrumental feel, because you couldn't do anything without the instruments, and that this, in fact, was the key to the whole development of radio astronomy, and in particular radio physics also. So that's the end of the interview with Jim Hyndman on 14 March 78.